The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
Well, this week on The Cyber Show, Bob MacGyver Monroe survives contact with the enemy. Vint has limited memory and uses Petri nets. Well, not exactly Petri nets. It's actually, well, a less restrictive Petri net to do it. What the heck was he was going to do with them anyway? Another pitcher tries to slide one past us. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enlighten. Events that fascinate and inform.
Enlighten San Francisco on April 16th will focus on countering malicious influence operations. This includes things like so-called phishing emails and vishing voice calls, cyber extortion, bullying, and similar methods, but also extends to larger scale operations like nation-state efforts to disrupt elections, deceptions surrounding international events, the propaganda that gets countries into war, and all manner of other related things. Several new companies will be pitching their emerging capabilities in this field, and some of the world's leading experts will be attending and giving talks, participating in panels, and holding discussions on paths forward. See the newest techniques and understand the future path with the emergence of next-generation surveillance and biomedical technology being used to directly influence individuals to specific actions. And see how the next generation of advertising and sales will get even closer to fully personalized influences to get you to buy now. Whether you're an executive responsible for the success of your company or a mother responsible for the well-being of your children, this is an event you will not want to miss. Wednesday, April 11th at the AMA Executive Conference Center in San Francisco at 780 Mission Street, starting at 8:30 a.m. Full details are available at thecybershow.co and online at eln3.com. And I'll be there in person. See you there.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The widespread media reports of the Baltimore Key Bridge collapse being caused by all sorts of idiotic fantasies of non-experts seeking publicity for crazy unsubstantiated theories have been all over the news. Of course, no real experts are willing to jump to such conclusions without facts, but if it bleeds, it leads. So I guess there's really nothing new that's breaking news on The Cyber Show. This week on The Cyber Show, Bob has to decide between being a mercenary or a hitman and decides he would rather look cool than get shot at. Vint gets into store and forward, but does he become a hoarder? Pitching perfection precludes personal progress. Enlighten San Francisco is less than a week away. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go! How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. In this segment, we're going to talk to Bob Monroe. Bob has a long history of being a hacker of one form or another, always in a legitimate way, always doing things in order to get the job done, so to speak. And of course, after he got out of his previous career, he started to work with Hacker High School to develop lessons that real people could understand. So when it comes to teaching people about cybersecurity and issues related to it, Bob is really outstanding. Here's Bob. when you were in Ranger school and doing all that stuff, how did you ever have time to find a woman who would have you and end up married to her?
That's a I'll tell you what, she's a saint. The 1st Ranger Battalion, they sent me to 1st Ranger Battalion, which is in Savannah, Georgia. And in Savannah, Georgia, there's Savannah College of Art and Design, SCAD. And they're, of course, an art school. They're teenagers, just like Rangers, but Rangers, you know, we've got our thing, and then art students, they got their thing. Those two are supposed to be oil and vinegar. We should not mix. We should not be compatible by any measure of the world. But actually, when we got together, we found that we had a lot in common. So a lot of us were hanging out together. So you got the art students from SCAD, and then you got the Rangers also hanging out, and we're having a wonderful time and doing what, you know, young adults do.
So I met in that era, what young adults do, we probably can't talk about on the air, right?
Oh, there's a lot. Oh, Savannah is a great place. There's fantastic food to eat. Some great bars. There's, you know, the river street. So there's so many amazing things to do in Savannah. And meeting my wife, she had been in Savannah for a number of years. So I came from Southern California. So I came on the other side of the United States. I didn't know anybody. So now all of a sudden I'm now meeting and hanging out with people that I would never meet ever. We're going sailing. We're going out fishing. We're doing all this stuff that because I now am with a local. So that worked out extremely well.
You married her there while you were in Savannah.
Yep, married her in Savannah, Georgia.
And then you were immediately moved somewhere else, right?
Well, being in a Ranger Battalion, they only want you in a Ranger Battalion for there's a, I forget the name of it, but there's a term for you moving on after a certain period of time. They basically want you to take your knowledge as a Ranger and go to another job. So what they do is after about, my turn was coming up. It was time for me to move on to another job. So I was going to go for Delta. And in fact, the guy that was with me the night I met my wife was the guy that was recruiting me.
So Delta is Delta Force, right?
Correct.
And tell us briefly what Delta Force does before we take a break, because we got to know.
Delta Force is a counterterrorism organization. They are what they call a tier one unit. So they mainly do hostage rescues, a lot of, like if you saw Black Hawk Down, they had Delta Force portrayed in that movie. So they're kind of like the big boys of special ops.
And so tell us, and by the way, by this time, you must have encountered lots of cyber stuff, right?
Yeah, we had some very interesting equipment while we were in the Ranger Battalion.
The stuff you're allowed to tell us about, tell us about it.
A lot of it, communication stuff, satellite radios, high-frequency radios. Then, of course, you're dealing with, you're doing calculations for, like, explosives. So it's a lot of math involved in that. It's not like you take a glob of something and stick it on the door, and it's not like it is in the movies. You know, you're writing all this stuff down. There's a lot of math involved in it.
So you know just how much of what sort of explosive to put where, under what circumstance, and how to shape it, and how to make sure that it's properly focused in its directionality, and how far to stand back when you set it off, right?
A long time ago, I did.
Well, so you mean to say you wouldn't want to do it now because you might, you know, skip a comma somewhere and end up without an arm?
Oh, I could tell some stories.
Go ahead. Go ahead. We'll love to hear them.
No, I don't think I'm allowed to tell some of these stories.
Okay. Fair enough. So, so you learned all these calculations, but you also had did you learn how to fix this equipment and how to assemble it and everything else associated with maintenance and repair and make new stuff out of the existing stuff? Is this a case of?
We did a lot of, not a lot of it, but it was, we were instructed on improvisation. So whatever the mission is, get the mission done. So if you have to put together two coconuts and some shoestring to make something, that's what they want you to do. Now, granted, we are incredibly fun.
Hang on.
Hang on. They instruct you on improvisation.
They encourage it. They don't instruct you.
Okay. So it's not like you have a course on improvisation. Because, you know, in the arts, of course, there's improv. Right? But, I mean, they put you in situations where you have to improvise, or they just, you know, come up with something new? Or how does that work? How do they teach you to improvise?
A lot of it is institutional knowledge that's passed down from the older Rangers to the younger Rangers.
MacGyver. That's the name of the guy, right?
Yeah, MacGyver. Yeah.
So you learn how to MacGyver it, right?
Yep. Yeah, pretty much the same thing.
So part of that is, as you gain this knowledge about how things work and why they work and how the chemicals work and what goes with what and what the underlying mechanisms are and the calculations, you learn enough so that you can sort of compose out of whatever things you have the thing that you want to produce, right?
Pretty much, yes. Is needed to get the mission done.
So when you say the mission, they tell you, here's what you're trying to accomplish, but they don't tell you, here's how you're going to do it, or you have to figure it out, or of course, what is it? No plan survives contact with the enemy. Is that?
That's where I was going to go with this is, yes, you can plan to the teeth, but it's going to fall apart as soon as you hit the ground.
does that always actually happen?
It's amazing, because that's what makes you really good at your job, is when everything falls apart, is being able to maintain your composure and still be able to get the job done, or maybe find another efficient way of doing it.
So this is the hacker ethos.
Very much so. Very much so.
Okay. So did you ever have a mission that went completely according to book? You planned it happened exactly as planned, and it all worked right?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I can't think of a single time that's ever worked out. You know, a radio breaks, or you can't get a hold of somebody, or your weapon jams, or whatever combobulation that you made, it breaks. You know, in Vietnam, they were really good about coming up with unique ways, for example, using clothespins for triggers for improvised explosives, or using the plastic spoon from your meal, repurposing it to make traps and things like that. So that kind of knowledge is passed down.
All right, interesting. So the art of survival in conflict situations is the art of innovation.
Correct.
Yeah, neither of us, to be clear, you know, I haven't. I don't think you have, you know, any military service. But we've both worked with so many military people over the years, and special forces, right? You know, and you know, the parallels really are fascinating. As I'm always saying, you know, there's engineering and there's hacking, right? And there's security engineering and there's hacking. You know, hacking is what you were just talking about. You know, that you have to figure it out. It's why I'm always like sailing and skiing and stuff like that, because you come over the rise and there's, oh, you have 3 to work it out. You know, one is coming really soon. You're going to have an answer. Trust yourself. And you do.
I think there's a simple equation here. Ranger equal hacker.
Well, that's true. True. Like anyone, you know, in the military context, you know, there's, you know, like anything, there's most people doing the job and they can be good at what they're doing. Then you get into the specialists, you know, and you start getting adaptable. It's not, in many ways, it's sort of the opposite. You know, all the classic stories, the British SAS, right? You know, military is mostly about organization, you know, getting a bunch of people to do the exact same thing at the same time. And then you take some people who are really good at that stuff and say, all right, make it up and just see what happens. And it's amazing, the emergent properties of skilled folks working in, you know, and again, not just make it up, but, you know, developing structures of innovation so that you can identify things that can be done and do them. You know, simple things like the OODA loop, you know, the observe, orient, decide, act, just a way of thinking about things, to anything else. I'm sorry, we got to cut there 1 second, because something huge just jumped in front of me, like the biggest splash. I missed it. It must have been a dolphin or a manatee. I got to go look. couldn't see what it was, right there, 60 feet away, it was like you took a hippopotamus and dropped it from 10 feet into the water. Boom, boosh, stuff.
And what was it?
I have no idea. It had to be a manatee or a dolphin. And I've seen the dolphins do. It's too windy right now for this, but when it's calm, dolphins will coordinate their efforts on a shoreline like that. At high tide, you get the fish up by the shore nibbling at the oysters and whatnot. And the dolphins will come along, and two or more, I've seen like six or eight of them go to half circle, and they'll all just chill out, and they'll all rush forward at the same time and curve in at the last second so that their wakes line up. And they'll create a wave, like 3 or 4 feet high in the flat water. And it'll come up, and it'll crash down. And what they're doing is they're forcing all the fish into one spot, and then they're f***ing with their entire ability to do schooling behavior and so forth. They're just, because they just make up, they take hundreds of pounds of water, they hang it on top of them for a split second, and drop it straight down. So the currents just go every direction, and the fish are just our food. Anyway, sorry for the
No, I think that's a great point to put in the middle of what Bob's talking about.
Right.
So that's their coordination of efforts. But, this idea that the more you know, the better you can do.
Right.
That's, I guess, in a lot of ways, that is the hacker ethos, right? It's really not a bunch of kids messing around. It's really not a malicious so-and-so who figured out one way in is going to exploit it again and again. That's not hacking.
No, that's whatever. It's something else.
Well, it's criminal behavior or what have you.
Right.
But the always learning, always adapting, that's the hacker ethos. Part of that makes them, in some sense, antisocial from the point of view of a society oriented towards everybody sits in the classroom and does the same thing. Everybody does the same job. And, it's sort of like when you talk about getting a bunch of hackers together to do something, it's almost antithetical to the process because each one of them wants to do what they do. And maybe that's one of the reasons some of the historical hacker groups have collapsed, gone after each other. The whole thing sort of falls apart when they become competitive and then decide that they resent the other person in one way or the other.
Well, and sometimes, unless you level up again, because if you're really a good hacker, you can recognize things like, the personality characteristics of folks like us, fall into predictable ranges on average. And the social characteristics, social behavior of taking a bunch of us and putting us one place, again, has, sort of predictable results. We've all seen it on sitcom TV. Therefore, if you want to have a good hacking group, factoring all those things in, we have happy hackers everywhere, right? It can be done. But it does. You're right. Many times, it's not just hackers. Smart people get together. It's like, we're all good at this. Let's be a group of people. Not realizing that group dynamics is its own skill set itself. You have to hack that too.
Yeah, hack the world, right?
Hack the world, right? So, in social media recently, some conversation about thing, and somebody posted this 300-ton crankshaft, this big Wartzilla motor that runs, most of the container ships out there, 300 container ships in the world. It's this beautiful 100,000 horsepower, monstrosity. It was reminding me, they'll tell this story here, in 1990, I worked at General Electric, and we built the first 150,000 horsepower fuel-driven motor, the biggest, most powerful fuel-driven motor in history. And it was 150 tons, and it was basically just a big turbine, the GE9000F. And being a hacker, my job was, I was hired to maintain the plant floor network, all the terminals and the connections to machine tools and so forth. So every day, I got a clipboard, I would walk every day up and down all the aisles. And they put in a video conference center. And I'm a hacker. This interests me. How do these turbines work? I don't know. These people build them. So I took cameras and I interviewed, the operators at every station of the manufacturing process and made a little documentary. So through that, I learned everything there was to know at the time about building a G9000F turbine. The dry low NOx system was new at the time. The ceramic coating on the buckets bringing the air in and all of it, right? So hacking is a you know, is a lifetime approach, right? In our industry, there are really good security engineers, you know, God bless them. I'm thinking of a couple right now that, you know, without them, you know, hackers couldn't get things done. And then there's hackers. Keep pulling on the threads.
Right. Well, but the other thing is, hackers trying to survive on their own, you know, that's sort of a problem. If they don't have the environment to work in, then they're going to go out and seek the environment in the open space of the world. And the commons are not a really safe place to do things. In many cases, you offend other people or bump into other people, and some of them, of course, end up in jail.
Well, and you know, we discussed this plenty too, right? And one of the risks is just personal. You may not get a lot of professional and, you know, financial success, right? And it's one of those pack the world things. Like if you're out there listening to this, you know, and you're an oddball hacker like Fred and I, you know, try to hack a little sociology, figure out how to get parts of groups, you know, where people are benefiting off of the stuff you like to do, so they can do the things you're no good at.
You know, how about those of us that just aren't that good at being in groups? We're not really the group kind of person.
Well, exactly, right? You know, that's you know, so, you know, my kids are all in their 20s, right? You know, so these generations, which, unlike, you know, mine, is a lot better at talking about things like neurodivergent and so forth, right? You know, it's not, you know, the norm plus, oh, the special people. But everybody's got their skills. So I'm hoping still in my life and in my working life to get better, you know, at being, I think, like younger folks just sort of natively are, many are, right? You know, so, you know, in the Department of Homeland Security working groups that I've been co-chairing, for example, you know, we tend to have 40 or so people. Most of them don't talk a lot, right? You know, for all sorts of reasons, but, you know, some of these folks are just not the really talky types, right? They're really, really good at what they do, and they found a way to interact with others that doesn't require them to be, you know, like I like to be, you know, the monkey on the stage. And that brings to mind, you know, Whit Diffie, you know, mutual friend. Whit Diffie is you know, the Diffie Hellman Key Exchange out there. He's one of these guys, you know, always reminds me of Colonel Sanders, long white beard. But he was the chief security officer at, I think it was Sun Microsystems at the time. But I was, you know, getting together with him and a couple of people, and one engineer got up and gave a presentation. And it was a very, very, very good presentation, you know, delivered all the information whatsoever. You can tell this is a person who was, you know, again, not big on the social contact side of things. It was monotone. It was, in many ways, the worst delivery you'd ever seen, except it wasn't. So it fit her mode entirely. So there's an example of someone who found a way to fit inside the social constructs. It's hard. Way harder than cryptography.
For some people, yeah. For some people, it's the other way around. There's actually, in studying group behaviors, one of the interesting results is that the optimal group has a bunch of experts who do not overlap. And the point being that if there's an overlap, you'll have experts that are disagreeing about minutia that actually agree with almost everything each other is saying, but it starts to dominate the time of the group, and it doesn't produce group performance, even though it might be fascinating to those two people. Right.
Yeah, and that happens. You know, anybody out there been listening in business, you must see this all the time. You know, I you know, very recent history flashbacks when you're saying that, right? You know, so navigating that. All right, you know, that's a great point, and I actually would really enjoy taking that off the corner and doing something with it. However, there's a whole bunch of us here, and we're trying to get this done, and I kind of don't think it matters.
Yeah, you know, when you say that to me, I say, it might not matter to you, but it matters to me. I'm going to keep going.
That's right. If we're going to be accurate on this one. Well, yeah, here's a good example. So in the Software Bill of Materials, the SBOM sharing working group, the Department of Homeland Security, we just published two documents. One, the SBOM sharing roles and considerations, should be on the cisa.gov/SBOM website right about now, by the time this is on the air. And the other one's probably 3-4 weeks out, but it's done. It's in the process. And the other one's the primer, six examples of how people are sharing SBOMs and the things they have to do, and, you know, how that works for them these days. And we map these to sophistication levels, as opposed to crawl, walk, run, right? You know, we're trying not to be, you know, not to take sides. It's not that there's, you know, bad and better, you know, and then perfect. It's that sometimes, you know, higher level sophistication is necessary.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not, and it tends to be expensive.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes, you know, from a security perspective, sometimes the best sophistication is none. just hand me the bloody thing, write it down, one time bad. But you know, to the point here, you know, you can't actually define sophistication that well. So fascinating conversations about, you know, our choices for, you know, pipe, you know, for the discovery, access, and transport, medium sophistication in this, you know, one example in the primer document. And you have to stop at some point because it's really an opinion.
So I'm part of several working groups of InterParis Trust. And it's a fascinating group of archivists from around the world. And they bring in people from other expertise and specialties to work with them. And the issue of definitions comes up all the time. So they have their own definitions. And they've been doing this for more than 20 years, you know, 25, coming up on maybe 27 years pretty soon. And the woman who runs this thing, Luciana Durante, is, you know, a stickler for this stuff. And she has created an environment where you can be picky, 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 and it works. Right? And so, you know, every 4 or 5 years, they come up with another term that they can define meaningfully and usefully. But then they enforce it. So when you're working with the group, you can't use those terms the wrong way. They actually review the papers and say, no, that's not what that word means. And new people come in for whatever the focus is. This time it's AI. I trust AI. And the AI people are using words like reliability from, you know, computer or whatever. And it's, no, that's not what it means for records, right? And so, you know, it takes a couple of years for these people to get to where they're starting to use the definitions properly. But, you know, it all gets struggled out because it's really hard to communicate, right? What's the expression? Words have two meanings, right? There's a song about that, right?
Yep.
Stairway to Heaven, maybe?
Well, and at the same time, there's no such thing as a synonym. So, yes, it gets worse and worse everywhere you look.
Yeah, so they're talking about veracity, and, you know, wow, there's a tough thing. They're trying to tackle the concept of, you know, what is the veracity of a record? That is, you know, how true is it? You know, now we're running into, because records, you know, they're produced by juridical processes. You know, juridical as in jurisdiction, right? So these are processes defined by a jurisdiction, so they're juridical in nature. And they're a process by which a record gets created that reflects the process of the jurisdiction. And that's what makes it a record. And so when you say, is it true? Well, they have these concepts of reliability and authenticity that have been, you know, hammered out over years, which completely different, right? In computer science, you know, authenticity, you'll talk about a bit changing, it's no longer authentic. Whereas for a record, you know, it can be authentic and the bits can all be different. It has to do with reflecting the juridical process accurately. So, you know, if it's your name, it doesn't matter what the bits are. If it looks like the, you know, linguistic characters in the right sequence in the language of issue, when you observe it, then it's authentic. That is to say, it's for the purpose. It's the right thing. Thus, you've changed the font. So what? You know, it's still your name on the driver's license. It's still a valid driver's license. So on the other hand, if the font is not a font that was actually used for driver's licenses at the time, then there's a question of the provenance. But of course, in the record keeping world and the archival world, there's transformation because the systems you used 50 years ago to record it are no longer here. So that text file is now recorded as, you know, something else. That picture, that photograph of a driver's license is no longer a photograph of a driver's license on a piece of paper or whatever the photographic material is. It got scanned. It's now bits. So all of these differences have to get hashed out. And you need precise definitions, common definitions, if you're going to do this. And if you don't have those things, then you can't spend 25 years working with people across multiple expertise, getting to where you can have reliable and authentic records in archives, and ultimately rely on those for who owns what and for the, you know, record of the juridical body. The United States has a constitution, right? The constitution's a physical piece of paper with handwriting on it that has degraded with time. But the word, the, you know, the words remain the same. It's still, it's in that archive. I'm sorry. And they don't actually mean the same thing today. The same words don't mean the same thing today. So you have people that argue in the legal system 200 plus years later about, you know, what so-and-so meant when they said we, the people, because, you know, we, the people, well, it didn't include slaves or women. Right. Or whoever, or Indian,
or non-landowning, you know, Caucasian men, yes.
Right. Well, whatever the, you know, so the meaning of the words change, but the archives are responsible for making sure that the records are maintained properly. So it's a fascinating field, and I know I've gone far afield, so I think it's time to get back to Bob.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Vint Cerf is one of the best known early internet ARPANET developers, researchers, and one of the folks that's considered by many as one of the founders of the internet as it exists. He has continued to work over many years for a variety of companies and doing a variety of different work related to forming networks. Here's Vint.
We're back with Vint Cerf. So operating system program, programming games, creating emulators for previous versions of IBM machines for the next generation of IBM machines. Okay, so this sounds like a fascinating career here. So somewhere along the line, so you got your PhD in computer science. And I thought there were no PhDs in computer science in that era.
Oh, well, 1964 is when Purdue first offered computer science as a degree. And they probably cranked out a PhD some few years after that. I got the second PhD in computer science at UCLA. One of my roommates, so to speak, office mates, got the first one. I remember we were kind of racing each other to see who could get their submission done first, and he won. So, yes, early in the 70s is the early days of computer
science. And what was your roommate's name?
It wasn't roommate. It was office mate. And,
office mate.
Let me think. Oh, this is so embarrassing. Names go right out of my head. He ended up at MIT for a while and then at JPL. It may come back to me in the course of this conversation.
Yeah, well, whenever it comes back, let us know, and we'll make sure to contact him and let him know that, you know. But what'll happen is he'll say, Vince, oh, I remember Vince. I forgot about that.
Yes, no doubt. No doubt.
Because that's, you know, but it wasn't that long ago. It's only, what, 70 years ago.
Well, more like 50, but it feels like 70, maybe. In terms of programming languages, I was using, of course, the various assembly languages, and then Fortran 4, typically, then Algol, Burroughs Algol, at Stanford as an undergraduate, and then...
All right, don't rush off from Algol. Okay, so the nice thing about Algol, right, is arrays started at 1 instead of 0, and the zeroth of the array was the length of the array, right?
Yes, I think if I'm, you know, I'm not sure that I would be able to have said that on my own, but I'll believe you if you think you're right.
Well, because this off by one error is induced by the zeroth element of an array. It's a very common error. And we actually, the guy that originally claims to have done that, wrote a public apology for it recently.
So that, do you remember, Edgar Dijkstra and his condemnation of the go-to,
but I have to tell you, you know, I understand go to into the middle of a loop or into a middle of a subroutine might not be a great idea. But on the other hand, you really can use it a lot of places. It's much more efficient. On the other hand, remember back then, you're using computers where you don't get that many calculations per second. Nowadays, you have so many cycles per second of computations that, you know, a couple of hundred, depths of recursion is almost meaningless in terms of the time differential, right?
Yes. The problem with the GoTo didn't have so much to do with speeding things up. It had to do with landing in the middle of the wrong place and not detecting that that had happened until too late.
Yeah, well, the computers still have them. And of course, you know, the bad guys still exploit that.
Oh, well, the bad guys exploit a lot of things about software bugs. And that is one of my big concerns these days, and has been for years, is that we have a lot of trouble writing software that doesn't have bugs. And when we do have bugs, we have trouble finding them.
So we should talk about that later. But let's go back to Algol, because I interrupted you in the middle of your sequence. So Algol, and did you ever do Snowball?
I didn't really use it. We studied it, and I learned, you know, I did a few examples. But you know,
APL.
I used PL1, but the thing that, while I was making a living writing software, mostly it was either assembly language or Fortran.
Did you ever do APL programming?
Yes, I did. And that was fun because the inventor of APL was at Stanford when I was there as an undergraduate. And so we were entertained by some of his challenges. He'd put up a very short one-line thing and say, "What does this do?"
Yeah. Actually, 16 hours later, you said, "We're not really sure. We think it adds two numbers together."
Right. Now, coming back to languages for just a second, when I was at...
But before you go away, I just want to note that I still have a keyboard that runs, has APL keys on. So when I run APL...
Wow, that's amazing. It's a great language. So while I was at UCLA, I had to modify a Fortran compiler so that when it compiled the Fortran, it would insert additional code in order for me to observe the behavior of the program. So I was measuring program performance at the time and trying to evaluate whether or not a particular program could be run faster in parallel than in the usual serial mode. And so I needed to do instrumentation. So I used a programming language called Meta5, which allowed me to write a compiler that Meta5 was a compiler, and you wrote the compiler in Meta5. And when you compiled that, you got a Fortran compiler. And when you compiled the Fortran program, what you got was an instrumented Fortran program. And when you executed that, you got data back from the execution of the program, which you could analyze. Right.
So did you ever use the Linux version of this stuff, like Yak and Lex and those things?
No, because Linux came quite a bit later than this time.
Well, I'm sorry, the Unix version, not Linux, Unix.
Well, even there, Unix is sort of in the... I didn't make heavy use of Unix personally. I made very heavy use of Unix once it had TCP/IP running in it, because that was the Berkeley release, which was quite helpful in spreading the internet.
Sure. All right. Well, so actually, we're getting pretty close to the time where the ARPANET was starting out.
That's right.
In your history. So everything up until the ARPANET. Take us everything up until when you started with the ARPANET, and then we'll take a break and we'll go to the ARPANET.
Well, I think we've pretty much finished everything, because the compiler work that I was doing was fed into both my master's and PhD dissertation.
And what was your dissertation title?
It was.
Yeah, doesn't it hurt? You spent years doing this to come up with this one paper on this one title, but you can't remember the name.
It was something like Semaphores, Parallelism, and a Graph Model of Computation. It's not too far off of that. Now that you've forced me to do this, I'm going to do a Google search here for SURF PhD dissertation title.
Okay. All right. So you're going to cheat and use computers. All right.
Yes, I am.
We all do.
And unfortunately, it didn't give me a good answer.
You know why? That's because that was before the ARPANET and the internet. So the history has forgotten all about it. You have to go to a physical library to even find it, right?
Yeah, this is really quite embarrassing. Not to remember.
Oh, no, that's all right. So get a copy of it somewhere from your bookshelf, scan it in, or if you have a digital copy that's still around, scan it in and send it out to us. No, because semaphores and you know, using graph theory to deal with the issues of sequential versus parallel processing is very important. And as an early one, it was probably actually something nobody had thought of before, right?
Well, I was making heavy use of PetriNet models in order to model the flow of control in a sequential program in order to determine whether or not it could be recalculated or recompiled to run in parallel.
See, now, that's fantastic. So when I was getting my PhD, one of the questions on the oral, it's not oral, but that exam where they hold you in the room and say, go do these things and come back and whenever you're done and then we'll talk about it.
That's sometimes called an exam, I think.
Well, I don't know what they call it, but so they asked me a PetriNet question.
Ah, really? Okay.
Absolutely. So I came back immediately they sent me off as many hours as I wanted to go and they're sitting in the meeting and I came back in about 45 minutes with their 8 questions answered. The PetriNet question, the answer is you can't do this with a PetriNet. They said, what? I said, well, the PetriNet only has, these functions, that are all right. What would you do with a PetriNet that includes whatever the additional function was? Oh, well, in that case, we'll go up to the board and write it down. But so PetriNets, were you using just regular PetriNets or some augmented PetriNet to allow you to do this? Because inversion, you can't do in PetriNets, right?
Yes, depends on whether it's an uninterpreted or an interpreted PetriNet. I did uninterpreted in my case because the net, if it was interpreted, the state space exploded. By the way, the answer is multiprocessors, semaphores, and a graph model of computation. So I wasn't too far off the mark.
That was pretty darn good. All right, excellent. All right, let's take a break here. So, Chris, what do you think?
I got to say it, start talking certain dates, right? I was born in 65, right? And I've been saying, in 64, in the university space. And it always, I feel like I say this all the time, but I guess I do, right? It's kind of the point, how has this changed in over what period of time? And there's no time like the one we've each been alive for. And I just, all these conversations, listening to you talk to Vint or all the people I talk to myself, I was putting this together on a line, right? And, and your last little bit there, I don't understand the reference, but I could picture it. I've seen you do it, right? Somebody gives you a question, you're like, great question, can't be done. It's like, no, you're supposed to say it. No, you don't understand how it works, right? So there we were.
Yeah, well, that's part of the... Part of the PhD, thing is that the professors are there trying to make sure that you understand the deep underlying aspects of it. And one of my favorite things to do when they're doing that is to say, well, maybe you don't understand the deep underlying aspects of the question you ask, which is, And so, that's my proof that I understand it deeply. In fact, more deeply apparently than they did. And then once they got the answer to the question, they said, okay, well, fix my foolishness in asking a bad question and give me the answer. Oh, no problem. Right. But,
folks, I got to relate this one. A cybersecurity company, once called Fred and I in to come talk to them. And one of their folks made the mistake of saying that their product was completely secure. And, I went out and got coffee. I came back and I think you were on 26 on the whiteboard. And they're like, oh, yeah, that one. It's like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Just don't even say that kind of stuff. Yeah. Just
don't say it to anybody. Don't say it to Fred. He will be very accurate in telling you exactly how wrong you are.
Well, this is part of the rigmarole of getting a PhD. Right, is that you're supposed to demonstrate your knowledge is not infinitely deep, but as deep goes. And it's very much the same in digital forensics. That's one of the reasons I like doing forensics work, and particularly digital forensics, is because I can go as deep as it goes. And, unless the person on the other side knows everything down to the bottom, I'm going to be able to go one or two levels deeper and cause them all sorts of problems because they just don't actually know the answer. And by the way, that's fun. Okay. For me. Okay.
Right.
And I think it's fun for, lots of people, but the other problem is, in those situations, people that actually know it all the way down to the bottom rarely disagree. Right. I mean, you may identify something that they missed and they say, oh, you know, I forgot about that. That's right. But I've never had a forensics case with a real expert on the other side that actually disagreed about anything once we got down to the facts of it. You know, once you say, look, here's the reference, here's the specific information, and they look at it and they, you know, there's just nothing to disagree about. Now, there are experts whose job it is to disagree. They're professional experts and they'll disagree with anything, you know, but they lose, right? They have a tendency to get, the judge will say, you can't keep testifying.
And I'll tell you, give everybody an example you can all relate to, you know, because this is how true this is. You know, Marissa Tomei in My Cousin Vinny on the Stand, that classic scene where she says, yeah, that car didn't make those tracks. And they have the expert and he knows all the stuff. And she goes, ding, 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 ding. And to your point, they turn back to the expert. He's like, oh, actually, she's right. that's just correct. Yeah.
Yep. So I love that aspect of the whole thing. And then there's the Algol thing, which I think is really important. I probably it was hard to, for anybody that doesn't know what this is about to understand it, but there's a very common error that's made that's one of the big software bugs that happens. It's called an off by one error. And so what happens is if you have a list of so many things, 15, 20, however many things, and there's a storage area intended to contain that list, then the typical program will go through the list, you know, for I equal 0 to the number of things in the list, N, and it'll increment the counter and go to the next, the next, the next, the next, the next. The thing is, the code I just stated is wrong because it's 0 to N minus 1, not 0 to N. That's the off by one error. So when in Algol, it started at 1. So 5 things would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So from I equal 1 to 5 for 5 things. But if you have 8 things and it starts at 0, then it's from 0 to 7, right? But you had 8 things, so it's 0 to the number of things minus 1. And it's just a mistake people make. You can't sort of help but make it. Not only that, when you ask what the length comes back 8, not 7. So now you ask what the length is and you count up to the length, but you're off by 1. And if you try going from 1 to 8, then you'll start offset from the beginning by 1 and you'll end up 1 past the end. So all of that is because it, you know, somebody at some point in time when it was originally not that way decided that all arrays start with the 0th element instead of the first element. So
I'm glad you said it exactly that way, because in the late 80s, when I was just in the computers, you know, I started teaching and I'm working with somebody who developed their own training and delivering with them. And they, you know, so I'm learning, learning all sorts of things, you know, and then teaching them the next day. But I'll never forget, you know, one of the artifacts that stuck with me is when he was explaining it, you know, when he, you know, watching him give a class. It was the 0th, the 1th, the 2th, the 3th, the 4th, right?
Not the 3rd and the 4th.
Right. You know, and the 4th, of course, gives you a problem because we already have a TH there. And it aligns with what I was thinking about this, you know, listening to you and Vint talk, you know, it's like, you know, so this week there was an the CISA, the Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, had a software bill of material in Espamarama, right? And it was a virtual event with several hundred people. And I was one of the speakers and we're reporting on the working groups and a couple of talks from interesting folks. And all of this stuff, you know, in this highly technical engineering world just comes back to me that it's all about people, right? It's down to things like, as you say, with Algol and so forth, an individual, somebody or some small number of people, 3, 5, maybe 7, right? Saying, all right, you know, we'll start with 1, or all right, we'll start with 0. And the ripple effects of that have more to do with how all this works out than how you can, you know, quantum encrypt, you know, the angels in the head of a pin, right?
Right. Crypto systems are the classic example, right? So there was a time when I learned, you know, all about cryptography and how to break cryptographic systems. I was a student of Len Edelman, of the Revis Shamir Edelman crypto system. He was, still is, I guess, one of the best, you know, crackers of cryptographic systems ever. But the problem is that, okay, I just don't have that mathematical skill and that analytical, you know, capacity to do what he can do. He's just bloody smarter than me in that way. But if you notice, the implementations all have flaws. So one of the times we were at Sandia National Laboratories, when I was there, we had a big parallel processor made up of old machines that we used to do all sorts of parallel processing. And it ended up, we were teaching law enforcement how to do investigations, and we had this parallel processor that could, you know, guess passwords or what have you, if you had things that were encrypted. So somebody in law enforcement came to us with an encrypted file in some case and said, can you do this? And it's now been enough years so I can tell the full story without worrying about somebody getting out of jail for free. So, you know, they bring us this thing, encrypted file, and we ran the algorithm that some of the students that I was working with and I came up with, and it guessed the password, or it guessed a workable password in maybe a couple hours, right? Now, the password it guessed was like a couple hundred bytes long, you know, just a, what you would think of as a random sequences of characters and numbers and who knows what, right? You know, pound signs. I mean, completely unguessable. There's no chance you could ever guess it in that time frame ever by brute force. And so we gave this guy the password. He's like, really? Yeah, he tried it and it worked. Okay, so he had the content of the file. How do you know it worked? Well, because the odds of getting a valid content of the file with anything but the right one are essentially zero, or so bloody close it doesn't matter. Or I'll say a right one instead of the right one. And so, you know, when he took this to court, you know, we were a confidential source. He had a confidential informant that provided him with the password. So I was notioning, you know, so when he asked me, how did you get it? I answered him, lucky guess. So how much luck is that? I was just picking random, you know, 800 byte sequences and I came up with one. No, turns out the implementation was flawed. They had made a mistake in the way they implemented the algorithm. And the mistake was such that you could take the content of the message and by trying a relatively small number of tries for the size of the space, guess something that would work. It was a password that would work, almost certainly not the original one that was put in to do it, because there are many passwords in that system that can produce the same result. We just came across one of them. And without going into further details, every cryptographic system we ended up examining, every steganographic system, you name it, they all have these flaws. Now, it's not that nobody can ever devise one that doesn't have some flaw. It's that we always found one. And it had nothing to do with cryptographic algorithms or mathematics. It had everything to do with people can't do this that well. Okay. So that's that. There was a couple other things that came up in there that hit my mind. One of them is computer languages and religion. So people seem to be like religious about, you know, I like Windows, I like Linux, I like Apple, whatever. It's a religion. VI.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Amen, right? So, and the same with computer languages. Oh, you know, oh God, no, not JavaScript. Oh, it has to be PHP. Oh, I can't stand PHP. It has to be, you know, Perl or whatever it is. They're religious about it. And it's a really bizarre thing because I guess I just grew up looking at enough of these languages and seeing enough of them that, you know, it's horses for courses in my view, right? Whatever works to do the job, you know, waste the least of my time in getting from here to there. That's the way you prototype it. And if you need something that's going to run 100 million times, you might worry about the efficiency differences. Except today, there are so many instructions per second that unless you're doing some complex computation where computational complexity is the key to the solution, it just doesn't matter. It will effectively do the same thing and do it just as well.
Well, you know, you know, as I say, you know, it's more about, you know, as we try to map all this technology, it's more about people than it is about technology, and kind of to your point as well. But the, you know, I like, you know, the great Sir Terry Pratchett, you know, has made his points in multiple books regarding Ankh-Morpork, you know, most successful culture around and the benevolent dictator of the time. And he makes the point that what people really want, despite what they say, is for tomorrow to look a lot like today. Right. And it resonates with my point about what, you know, I've made this over and over for the last 30 years. And when people are going out to buy cybersecurity, what's the number one thing they're looking for? And the answer remains the same. And the answer is comfort. You know, it's not encryption. It's not to solve this, that, the other. They're trying to be comfortable. And as we get more and more automated, you know, as machines of all descriptions, you know, do more for us, we, you know, look more at what makes us human, what makes us unique. And that kind of thing, as I was saying with, you know, the zeroth and the oneth and the twoth and so forth, it's these human things inflect everything about all the technology and this basic human thing that people really like to keep coding in the same language because they can do it in their sleep. Right. That's why they like it.
You're used to it. Yeah. You're used to it. That's right.
You're comfortable. All right. It doesn't present anxieties and stresses and so forth. We seek this medium, you know, mean free path, you know, where the resistance is minimal.
We need to think about that
as we design systems, because that's how people work.
Also, the nature of these things is that there's lots of obvious stuff, and then there's these little inobvious things, right? So there are these bugs or these edges where things don't work right. So you're used to driving a particular car that steers in a particular way, and you can pick up any car and drive it. But if you're right at the edge of driving near a cliff and you do it a little bit wrong, you overcompensate and you go over the cliff, right? So in computer languages, there are just these minor little, oh, this is not a less than here, it's a less than or equal, or I need a space here, or this is a semicolon in this case instead of a period, these sorts of things. And those are the things that take the amount of time it takes to write code from 5 minutes to 5 hours, you know, for this one little routine you're getting, you know, the wrong answer from, you have to debug it. And all that's because of that lack of intimate familiarity with that specific language in that particular environment, which brings us to the whole brittleness issue, which I will not go into now because there's another thing to bring up about the conversation. And that's the, remember everything you did. I can't remember the name of my dissertation, which I spent years writing. So I go look it up on Google. And of course, we all know who Vint works for, right? So he looks up his dissertation on Google and can't find it. And it's got to be the most, you know, frustrating, I don't want to use the other words for it, thing you could ever imagine. To not, my own dissertation, where is it? And, you know, eventually he finds it on the shelf or whatever. So this whole idea that nothing existed before the internet in terms of research, right? People don't even recognize when they look for stuff. If you don't find it in a quick internet search, you're just not going to bother because you found so many other things that you think you don't need it anymore, but you maybe missed the most important thing of all. So the lack of history is interesting. And then there's one other thing he brought up, and that was the Trojan horse that he put into the Fortran compiler. To do instrumentation, right? That is, in his version of the compiler, it did something that the normal user doesn't know it does, and that's that instrumentation, or we could call it spyware, right? It's collecting information you didn't know it was collecting and making it available for him. And Peter Denning wrote, or asserts that he wrote and published in a paper, a famous paper, just prior to the papers on computer viruses, although I guess it came out after them, about a C compiler, which compiled a bug into future C compilers. So when you would compile a new C compiler with the old C compiler, which is how you compile C compilers or other compilers, because it's written in itself, it's written in C. When you would compile it next time, it would propagate that bug into the next version. So even if your source code didn't have that bug in it, the bug would be propagated. And it's the same thing, right? This is years before that C compiler was claimed to have been put there. And we're putting instrumentation into things and making it appear that it's not there. So it runs the same as it did without the instrumentation. And lots of Trojan horses have methods of hiding themselves to try to make it so you can't find them. I don't think that that's what Vint did in his case, but I just thought I would bring it up that there's this long history of make it do something else and don't bother to tell everybody about it. I'm just trying to use it for this purpose. And sometimes those things get stuck there.
Well, you know, I'll take the opportunity to place another stake in the transparency timeline, right? You know, because again, as you know, the timelines we're talking about, we're literally, you guys, all of us since then have been building this thing. Let's get it bloody working, right? And that consumes 99.99% of the time, you know, and just, you know, instrumentation on a C compiler with C compilers is probably a good idea, right? You know, and, you know, so it's most of this data, you know, we look at, you know, data that flows around. Most was there for a good reason, a non-nefarious reason. But we haven't built in transparency.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bob has to decide between being a mercenary or a hitman and decides he would rather look cool than get shot at.
Vint gets into store and forward, but does he become a hoarder? Pitching perfection precludes personal progress, and light in San Francisco is less than a week away. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.